Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Hey, welcome to The Exchange. I'm John Fortin with green on the screen and the major averages. Here's what's ahead. Abandoned tech at your own peril, says our market guest. But he isn't just buying any tech. He joins with two tickers to consider from here. And speaking of tech, NVIDIA announcing an extended partnership with Databricks just yesterday. Today, the co-founder and CEO of Databricks is going to join us for an exclusive interview ahead. We're going to ask him about that and that possible IPO in the works. And more clues on housing. We're going to have the latest data and talk to someone who's got a front row seat to buying and selling trends across the country. But we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu with the latest numbers. Dom.
John, as you point out, it's green across the screen right now, but the tech trade, which has been the leader for the last several days and even months and quarters and years at this point, is the underperformer in today's trade. We'll go through that in just a couple moments here, but it's the blue chip Dow Industrials Index that's up nearly 300 points, 291 to the upside. That's 0.75% gain there, 39,080 the last trade there. So a laggard is the leader in today's trade. The S&P 500, the broader measure, 5170 the last trade. They're up about 20 points. At the highs of the session, we were up 23. So again, near session highs, we were actually down 18 points at the lows of the session. We're up 0.5% there. And the tech heavier NASDAQ composite index up 16,151. That's up 48 points, roughly 0.33%. So it's the laggard in today's trade. Now, I'd mentioned that technology trade. Crypto is kind of part of that narrative right now. Check out what's happening with Bitcoin prices. Currently down about 3.5%, 64,800 and change or thereabouts. Ethereum prices down 5%, 3,300. Remember, just in the last several days, Bitcoin prices were above 73. Ether prices were above 4,000. So we've given a lot back. As a result, check out Coinbase Global, Marathon Digital, MicroStrategy. Many stocks in that crypto ecosystem are all down notably with today's trading. And then specifically on technology, check out NVIDIA, the third biggest stock in the S&P 500. Massive weighting over there. NVIDIA shares now swinging to the upside. They were down solidly earlier today on the heels of that big announcement of Blackwell, their new AI chip. Advanced Micro, though, is down 4.5%, a competitor with regard to chips there. But Super Micro down 9%. They're going to issue more shares as part of their run-up recently as of late. C3 AI, UiPath, a couple of the other names that people use as AI-type plays, also down in today's session. So watch that technology trade. An interesting reversal, John, for NVIDIA right now. We'll see if it sticks. I'll send things back over to you.
All right, Dom, of course, we can't help but watch NVIDIA. But for a moment, we're going to talk also about the Fed's decision on interest rates. That's just about 24 hours away. That's where we're going to start with Steve Leisman and the latest results from the CNBC Fed survey. Steve.
Hey, John, thanks. Yeah, respondents to the CNBC Fed survey for March seeing slower growth than last year, but showing more confidence in a soft landing and less concern, of course, about a recession than we've seen in the past 2 years. Take a look. The recession probability has declined to 32%. That's the lowest since February 2022, well down from the high of 63% in November 2022. The probability of a soft landing is at 52%, up from 47% in the January survey and 40% in July. Here are the numbers. GDP 161, 1.61% expected, slightly below trend, but a lot better, we'll see in a second, than had been the forecast before, with the economy going back to what's considered to be potential next year. CPI comes down over a two-year period to just about what the Fed's target is, because a 2.5 on the CPI is equivalent to about the 2% on the PCE. And there's just a 0.3 of an uptick from the current level for the unemployment rate over the next 2 years. John Donaldson, director of fixed income at the Haverford Trust Company, writes in, for now, the narrative of the U.S. economy is so fragile that it cannot survive without ultra-low rates has been debunked and discarded into the rubbish of history. Well, we'll see about that. Take a look at what had been the forecast for this year. It has come up over four separate surveys now, almost double what it was. And it's really the first time we haven't seen a big slowdown in the forecast over the last 2 years. Now the current level seen again at 1.61%. One critical debate for the Fed, if the recent surge in productivity is for real, 36% saying it's temporary, but 28% hold out hope it's the beginning of a long-term shift, and 16% call it due to normal volatility. Okay, importantly, the average neutral rate for respondents, 3.1%, a bit higher than the Fed's 2.5%, which is to say respondents don't think the Fed, John, is quite as tight as the Fed itself believes it to be.
All right, Steve, stick with me. Our next guest says the market and the Fed are currently aligned on 3 cuts this year, but also says it doesn't take much for the Fed to scale back to 2. Joining me now is Paul McCulley, former chief economist at PIMCO, currently an adjunct professor at Georgetown McDonough School of Business. Paul, what's the big open question for tomorrow when we hear more from the Fed?
I think there are a number of them. Most important will be what the results of the dot plot are. And it actually drives me nuts to have to say that, because I think the essential message of the Fed is pretty clear. And that came clear last December when the Fed rhetorically pivoted and put 3 cuts into the outlook for this year. Between then and now, the marketplace has been all over the place, but they're in alignment right now. They're in a really good place of alignment with the Fed. So I don't think that the Fed needs to change anything really in the dot plot. But because how it comes together, if you were to have 2 Fed participants move from looking for 3 to 2, it would flip the median to 2. But I think that if that happens, Chair Powell can clean it up in the pressure. The fundamental message from the Fed is the same it's been since effectively he laid it out to the public in 60 Minutes, is that tightening's over, easing coming, not too far away, most likely to start in June, and 3 cuts this year. And that is, in fact, my base case forecast.
Paul, as we get closer to June, though, does the language have to shift at all? If he says the exact same thing, does that feel like, well, maybe it's farther out than June?
I don't think he'll say the exact same thing. But to your point, there will be 3 sets of inflation data and job data between here and June, and they will need to be a little bit friendlier, particularly on the inflation side, than they've been so far this year. But that is essentially the path. And I think Chair Powell will note, we got 3 more looks at this whole thing. So he's not going to pound the table about June, but he's not going to push back against it, would be my bottom line.
Steve Leisman, how much of an issue, a sticky wicket, is this services inflation that we see being pretty stubborn here?
I mean, I think it's still an issue. It's still something that he's going to cite as part of the reluctance to begin cutting right now. I think that's going to be an issue. And also, this level of confidence that it will take to get the Federal Reserve to cut is an interesting question. January and February are almost a complete reset. John, this is a bit like, you know, you're trying to pin down a wrestler and the ref says 1, 2, and the guy gets up. You got to start all over again. That's what's needed for the confidence. We got to get 3 in a row here. We really haven't had it. We had a really good 2023 when it came to inflation. Things came down, but now we're kind of stuck. And there's a couple really interesting policy questions the Fed has to make here. The most interesting to me is this one about the sacrifice ratio. Essentially, how much is the Fed willing to give up in terms of economic growth, in terms of unemployment, to get to that last part or the last 1 percentage point we need to get down to the 2% target? I think that's a question that it's interesting to hear, might be interesting to hear Powell respond to.
Steve, is it me or like a year and a half ago, I feel like a lot of people were saying, oh, the Fed, they don't know what they're doing. They're going to drive this economy, you know, into the ground. Soft landing is next to impossible. They're ruining it. They're ruining it. And they're, you know, they're not going to do what they say they're going to do. And yet here we are. And it kind of looks like maybe people are coming around to, well, maybe the Fed's kind of going to do what they said they were going to do. And maybe they haven't botched this whole thing. No?
Yeah, and I think that comes down to the question, John, of how much time the Fed has to decide here. You're right. A lot of people were very wrong about the Fed last year. They were not open to the idea that things were substantially different in the wake of the pandemic than they had been previous, you know, in previous tightening cycles. But it does remain a question about how much time the Fed has to get this right. There are companies that are going to have to refinance. There are, but we still have those decent growth numbers built in terms of the forecast. But I think it's also important to say that some of those forecasts, Johns, are contingent upon rates coming down.
Paul, what's the most concerning, maybe, is the, there's too much bias on it, but I'm looking at some of the consumer debt numbers. I'm looking at some of the employment, the labor market numbers, and things loosening up a bit. What do you think is the most important thing that the Fed is going to have to keep an eye on, consider over the next several weeks?
Oh, it's interesting you said over the next several weeks. I don't think there's anything explosive going on the credit side of things. Those are things that we monitor looking out over the next 6, 12, 18 months. I think, you know, looking out in the weeks immediately ahead, the Fed very much does want to see in the next couple series of inflation prints friendlier data. And I actually think it will, including on the CPI, because last month, even though it was greater than expected, we finally saw a crack in owner's equivalent rent, or OER. That was huge because of the weight in that index. So I think we're going to be tamer on the CPI data going forward, in part because of OER. But they will be focused pretty intensely on that from the standpoint of economic wonkery. And I think they will also be focused on just how exuberant risk markets are. They have put in a huge amount of accommodation in the marketplace already. So I don't think they want the marketplace to run away from them again from here. So I think they'll be looking at the data and also looking at the environment. But more fundamentally, I think the decision has been made that they're going to start an easing process this year. In fact, Chair Powell told Congress that. So I think the decision has been made. So there would have to be some type of data that would change that core strategic decision that would disturb essentially the path that we're on for the easing cycle to begin here in the second half of this year, most likely starting in June. Right. And if it's July, that's okay.
Right. Well, we're kind of like kids in the back of the car. Are we there yet? Are we ready to start cutting? Paul, Steve Liesman, thank you. Well, following a year of major gains in tech, our next guest is sticking with that trade from here, but doing it in a very specific way. For more, we're joined by Mark Avalone. He is Potomac Wealth Advisors President. Mark, you're trying to get away from some of these companies that have been big tech players and maybe gone up a little too fast. How do you do that?
Well, you'd use the tried and true principle of diversification. I think a lot of investors are not aware that if they're in the S&P 500, they're in the triple Qs or in the XLK, the prominent tech ETF, they own Apple and Microsoft and other big names, and they're massively overweighted. Look, in the XLK, Apple and Microsoft are over 42% of that allegedly diversified tech ETF. So what we want to do is offer that same comfort of diversification, get away from the Mag 7, and use more of an equal weight approach. And we do that using the JP Morgan Tech Leaders ETF. First Trust has a NASDAQ 100, more of an equal weight ETF. And this way we get exposure to the great industry of our time, the one that's not only great within itself, but making tech-enabled companies great. And we allow it to have a slightly less risk profile and move away from the Mag 7.
How strong a gut do you have to do that, though? Because there's this Russell 2000 problem where things that aren't big just really haven't been performing well, especially when there are interest rate concerns.
Well, that's a great point. These are also large, prominent companies. They're names we know. They're just not small and emerging technology. They're established tech companies that may be a little bit more overlooked. But on that small cap trade, gosh, if this economy keeps going the way it's going, and if the Fed has to sit on the sidelines because the economy is doing this well, that typically is a good environment for small cap. And we think that small cap core, small cap growth side would be a little better for that, because we are a little concerned about small value and their exposure to community banks.
Speaking of community banks, how do you view that and the regional bank issues as we look across multifamily and we look across office and see some spots of trouble?
Well, we are concerned about small and community banks. There's a couple of reasons. One is a massive structural disadvantage they have in the cost of deposit gathering. If you talk to bank presidents, they acknowledge that an internet-based bank or a behemoth like a Bank of America or a JP Morgan have at least a 100 basis point, if not 150 basis point advantage in gathering deposits. And that will crush a gross margin, a profit margin, when your cost of goods sold goes up. And I think that's pretty simple. People forget about it in banks, but that's how bank profits start. We also think the real estate exposure is a bit of a bubble. Banks have been putting it off, restructuring quietly. And we think, again, small and mid-sized banks will face the bigger brunt of that pain.
All right. Yeah, watch out. We're showing the KRE there, close to 4750. Mark, thank you. Mark Avalone from Potomac
here.
Wealth Advisors. Well, coming up, NVIDIA trying to continue its record-winning streak after the company unveiled its latest generation of AI chips. Up next, we're going to tell you when they're coming to market and speak with the CEO of one company that's got a new partnership with NVIDIA and is on Wall Street's watch list for a potential IPO. Plus, we're talking oil and gas with the CEO of SLB, formerly known as Schlumberger. The stock's trying for its sixth straight week of gains. That would be its longest streak in nearly a decade. Later on, the CEO is going to join us live from CERAWeek in Houston. The exchange is back after this.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Canva. What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange. NVIDIA unveiling its latest AI chips at its developers conference. Here's what CEO Jensen Huang told Jim Cramer about the investment behind the announcement.
This will cost, you know, $30,000, $40,000.
And how much did you spend to develop?
The very first one, the R&D budget of this generation is probably something like $10
billion. $10 billion, not million, $10
billion.
Billion with a B. Christina Pratsenevelis is at the conference in San Jose, California for day two. Christina.
Well, NVIDIA is not a chip company. It's, quote, an algorithm-first company. CEO Jensen Huang just finished up a Q&A with financial analysts at a hotel down the street, and it felt more like he was positioning the company as a cloud service provider before all else. Huang confidently saying, quote, we basically run everything, since they not only provide the GPUs, but the CPUs, the Ethernets, the software, and now pre-built AI models in the form of a new subscription model called NIM, which stands for NVIDIA Inference Microservice. That service will cost companies around $4,500 per GPU per year. Companies do have many GPUs, so you can understand the costs are going to be high, but it is a reoccurring source of revenue for NVIDIA and shows how NVIDIA plans to monetize software, a key for its future demand. NVIDIA also announcing its Blackwell platform, which offers new GPU chips. Earlier, and through that soundbite you just heard, Jensen told CNBC that chip would cost between $30,000 to $40,000, but I followed up with NVIDIA NVIDIA's team on this specific chip and if others would cost more, and they wouldn't clarify. So we're not sure yet just which chip he was referring to. The CFO just took to the stage too, reiterated they would come to market these chips later this year, and we should, as she said on the recent earnings call, expect supply constraints. Another important takeaway from Jensen's comments today was about the $1 trillion total addressable market. It's, quote, $1 trillion installed, $250 billion a year. We sell that entire data center in parts. So our percentage of that $250 billion is likely a lot higher than somebody who sells a chip. So our percentage of $250 billion will likely be higher than in the past. And those were the comments that helped reverse earlier losses in the share price. Stock, though, is still up, what, 82% year to date?
Yeah, fractionally higher now. And this is a message that Jensen's been trying to hammer home for a couple quarters now. I know we certainly heard it after earnings most recently, but he's got a big stage to do it on now. It's interesting to understand what he's talking about and being able to charge customers per GPU. It's to keep their software, their offerings up to date with the latest technology, backward compatible. In a way, it's like Apple's App Store, right? Like you pay to be on it, you pay to remain updated, and it's an ongoing stream of revenue. It doesn't have to keep on selling chips in order to make money.
Yeah, which makes the switching costs so high, which does not bode well for competitors that are in the market, which is why you saw the negative reaction in AMD stock price, just because you did have NVIDIA not only with the GPUs, but also the CUDA software that's used by a lot of developers. And now this entire package, you know, with pre-built AI models that they're offering, the license that we just talked about at $4,500 per year per GPU. So that adds up and makes it even more difficult for companies to switch. And I thought it really telling that Jensen Huang said today, quote, we run everything. That's a pretty bold statement. And maybe, I guess, a rethink whenever we just refer to this company as a chip company now, when really they are claiming they're more algorithm and software first.
Yeah, that might be a little uncomfortable eventually for AWS and for Microsoft Azure. Christina, thank you. By the way, you can catch more of NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang's interview with Jim Cramer tonight on Mad Money at 6 p.m. Eastern. Well, NVIDIA is an investor in my next guest company and just announced an expanded partnership with it at GTC yesterday. That company's Databricks, current valuation of around $43 billion, also on the street's IPO watch. Joining me now in an exchange exclusive to discuss all of this, CEO and co-founder Ali Ghodsi. Ali, good to see you. So many NVIDIA partnerships getting floated around out there. I saw Snowflake said they had one too. So what's special about yours?
What's really special is that customers are coming to us and saying, we want to build our own generative AI models. So there are these really smart ones out there like ChatGPT, everybody uses them, but enterprises want their own so that they can compete with their competitors and have their own IP. So we're probably the vendor on the planet that has built the most number of custom AI models for our customers, and we do that on NVIDIA chips. And you know, we're excited about the Blackwell 200 that's coming out and many of the other movements that are happening in this GPU space. So business is booming. Everybody's interested in building their own AI models today.
Are you comfortable that you see the limits of NVIDIA's ambitions here and where it's safe to partner versus where, I mean, if they're saying, is Jensen saying they do it all, are they going to do what you do?
Well, look, I think they're amazing at that particular thing that they do. They do also span and do many other things, but, you know, it's a big market. The TAM for AI is going to be gigantic, right? It impacts pretty much anything on the planet that's happening. So there's going to be room for lots of players. And, you know, if someone should be worried, it's probably Databricks is probably not number one on the list.
Yeah, I agree. Based on what I see, that makes sense. Now, a couple of weeks ago, you were saying that you expect the price of accelerators, and that's just the chips part of what's being used right now to develop a lot of these models. You expect the price of that to come down in the next couple of years. Is that still your expectation? Because it sounds like part of what Jensen is saying about NVIDIA is, hey, we do a lot more than just sell accelerator chips. And by the way, people are going to need a lot of this technology for inferencing as well.
Yeah, so I wasn't commenting on how NVIDIA will do. I think NVIDIA will do fabulously. I'm just commenting on the price of GPUs, right? The supply of these GPUs is just increasing. There's just so many vendors that are coming to the market with their own variants. And, you know, there's just, you know, there's been so much demand for these. And I think the supply will increase this year. And we're already seeing it when we talk to the folks that sell these. Before it was, you have to commit to me and buy lots of them 3 years in advance and pay for them 24/7. Now negotiations are sort of lightening up and they're saying, hey, how about you just commit to just having them for 1 year? Or how about you buy them for 6 months? And the prices have also like sort of come down in the negotiations. So that is happening. Now, NVIDIA is on a tear and there's no doubt about it.
Ali, in what industry do you expect we're going to see the needle moving productivity gains in AI show up at the macro level first?
Yeah, look, it's already happening in customer service. That's the most obvious one, right? But, you know, we're also seeing it now start affecting financial services. So financial services are using these generative AI models to sift through massive amounts of financial documents, you know, SEC filings and so on, and just extracting, you know, is there signal anywhere? Can we do anything? Can we improve alpha doing that? So that's one big one. Insurance companies, they want to do underwriting. They want to assess risk. Again, these large language models, generative AI models, can sift through massive amounts of documents and assess risk. And then, you know, classic AI, we shouldn't forget about that too. It's not just generative AI. You know, a customer like Rivian uses us for all kinds of things, like figuring out how far away you should be from the car in front of you. How do you switch lanes? How do you optimize the battery of your car? So this is going to have impact on every industry, but the ones I mentioned, I think, are the first one that are coming up.
I thought about communications and marketing when I saw IBM's layoff news. They didn't put it out there, but it got put out there. I mean, if generative AI can generate content, maybe some of the people in those industries need to worry.
Well, I think that, I mean, I've said this before, I think people got overexcited. This is like 1999. The, you know, markets immediately priced in the next 10 years of innovation. And they said, okay, we're creating super God and, you know, all jobs are gone by the end of 2023. And then by the end of 2023, it was like, wait, none of that happened. So what's going on now? So I do think there's sort of a little bit of resetting happening in expectations. I think this is going to be amazing, just like the internet was. But it takes years for people to change their jobs, change their behaviors, how they're going to use this, adopt this technology. It's as simple as this. Even if we make amazing revolutions in AI, if no human being wants to ever use it, then it will have zero impact. So we have to get the humans to use the stuff and make it valuable for them, and that's going to take years.
All right, speaking of expectations, should we bet that Databricks IPOs in 24 or 25?
I don't know. It really depends on the market conditions, right? This is a interesting year, election year, a lot going around the world. You know, we have interest rates. They were supposed to lower them, but, you know, I don't know what's going on there.
Okay. Depends on market conditions, and that's who knows. Maybe AI can help us figure that out. Ali Goetze from Databricks. Thank you. Well, still ahead, the country's housing shortage is going to get worse before it gets better. And that's according to the CEO of one real estate manager and developer. We're going to ask him why and what he's doing to take advantage of the trends he sees. That's when The Exchange comes right back after this.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block. Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. I'm Tyler Matheson with your CNBC News update. The White House said U.S. and Israeli officials will likely meet early next week in Washington to discuss Israel's pending operation in Rafah. The meeting comes after President Biden and Bibi Netanyahu spoke on the phone yesterday, where Biden urged Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza as reports of famine in the area have been growing. Hawaii's attorney general is blaming the delay in the release of a report into the deadly 2023 Lahaina wildfire on county agencies in Maui. The first part of the investigation, which was scheduled to be released this month, is now not expected until April 17th, following delays in gathering key information needed for the report. The AG's office says that it had to issue subpoenas to three county agencies over their slow response. And Netflix is taking viewers back inside the huddle with a new football docuseries, this time from the perspective of some of the NFL's best wide receivers. It comes on the success of last year's series on the quarterbacks. Receiver will follow Devontae Adams, Justin Jefferson, George Kittle, Debo Samuel, and Amon-Ra St. Brown during the 2023 season. Amon-Ra St. Brown, he's a Lion, I knew that. John.
So much easier when it was just Jerry Rice.
Yeah.
Tyler, thanks. Coming up, we're going to go live to CERAWeek in Houston with the CEO of oil field services firm SLB. His take on global oil demand, reducing emissions, and the role that AI is going to play in the energy space next.
In 1919, activists worldwide urged their governments to create policies to help working mothers. Today, half of public companies in the U.S. offer paid parental leave for primary caregivers, and 49% offer some leave for secondary caregivers, enabling partners to actively share childcare responsibilities. Celebrating Women's History Month, I'm Julia Boorstin.
Welcome back to The Exchange. Energy prices hovering near four-month highs with both West Texas and Brent crude up a little more than 0.5% today. Let's get now to Houston, where CERAWeek is underway, and CNBC's Brian Sullivan is with the CEO of SLB. Brian.
Thank you very much, John. Yeah, the company formerly known as Schlumberger, the largest oil and gas services firm in the world, digital transformation, energy transformation. Maybe we'll talk a little bit of AI. Olivier Lepouche is the CEO, and he joins us now. Olivier, thank you for joining
us. Thank you.
Really appreciate that. So the price of oil is up today. What is the relationship for your investors watching between the price of oil and your business? Because I would view you as maybe the ultimate leading indicator of the energy economy.
I mean, you need to look at the pricing as an indicator of future demand. And I think our view on the demand of oil, demand of gas, is very positive for the rest of the decade. And it has constructive implication onto the longevity, the strength, and the breadth of the cycle. And I think we benefit from longevity of the cycle. We benefit from our exposure international market, which is where the investment is rotating, to fit and to supply this demand that we see forward. So oil price going up, it could only be indicative of stable investment opportunity for our customers, resulting into us being exposed to technology integration and activity uptake international market.
Even the International Energy Agency, which has been a little more bearish, they just raised their demand forecast, I think probably reluctantly, for this year and for next year. So it sounds like you're pretty optimistic about energy, oil and gas demand.
I think it has been for a long time and for decades a direct correlation between the economic growth, energy intensity, and oil and gas demand. And I think this has, over time, two factor of efficiency transformed, but the energy system is still in place, still use oil and gas as the basis for fueling this energy growth, this demand growth, and we are very pleased to be associated with that and preparing on a next chapter in new energy at the same time.
You stole my next question, Olivier, because John, my good friend John Fort, we're talking about NVIDIA today. We're talking about AI, artificial intelligence, the growth of data centers, the growth of energy demand. And what's amazing is what I'm learning here, and it sounds like what you're saying, please confirm, that companies like SLB, we think of them as energy, but you're also kind of an AI play, I think.
We are a technology company at the core. Our DNA is science, technology, innovation. And we have a global footprint. So we use these two to develop our balance, what we call our balance strategy. Core oil and gas, developing the performance, the efficiency, the next level of recovery, digital, and creating this as a vehicle for efficiency, capital efficiency, operational performance, and next level of transformation of the way we work, and new energy. And digital is the domain where we had invested for the last 30 years. We did not miss the cloud transformation, we did not miss the AI transformation, and AI is becoming the X factor, as we call it, of digital transformation in our industry. It's breaking new paradigm, the paradigm of digital operation being autonomously run, automated, and creating new benchmark of performance when we introduce it.
And you have to do it responsibly, because climate change, net zero, 1.5 degrees, that's a macro theme here. A lot of people just kind of want the hydrocarbon industry to go away, I get it, but it's not going away. And nobody is saying it will, and demand is, to your point, anybody you look at, it's only going to grow. How do we accomplish the goal of growing demand, growing supply, but not damaging the planet more than we have.
Our responsibility as an industry and our responsibility as a technology provider to this industry is to help accelerate the path to decarbonize our industry. Today, the oil and gas operation are emitting methane through venting, to fugitive emission, to flaring, and are consuming quite a lot of energy to explore, produce, develop, process the product, the oil product and the gas product we sell to the market. Our first and big opportunity is to decarbonize and to provide technology platform to work in partnership to accelerate this. If we do this, I think we'll have a more responsible future as an energy industry. I think we'll be more balanced in the way we provide oil and gas products that are part of the fabric of our society, and at the same time, decarbonize product, decarbonize oil in its own production, decarbonize gas in its own production, and realize net zero footprint for well construction, net zero footprint for production, electrification, methane,
everything,
and digital transformation. Digital is certainly the vector that will accelerate the most this efficiency step change into decarbonization.
Olivier Lepouche is the CEO of SLB, and we really appreciate you joining us. John, you see what we did there. You know that, I know you've been talking about NVIDIA and AI all day. This too is kind of the, this is the stuff that makes the stuff that makes the AI work. So we had to get, we're contractually obligated, as I've said, to mention NVIDIA every block. So
still weaving, still weaving. I appreciate it. Brian Sullivan, thank you.
Thanks,
and
John. All right.
Olivier Lepouche. Coming up, President Biden opposing Nippon Steel's takeover of U.S. Steel. CEO of one U.S.-based materials company touting their advantages to getting a deal done, pushing shares higher today. The name that could prevail next. And I want to draw your attention to Kering, the luxury company issuing preliminary first quarter results, expecting consolidated revenue to decline by about 10% from the previous year, citing softness in Gucci sales in the Asia-Pacific region. Kering expecting Gucci revenues to fall 20% year over year, and the company has previously said it expects the first half to be challenging. Shares of its unsponsored over-the-counter ADR down, you can see about 8% on that news. Be right back. See the Dow there near session highs. Welcome back to the exchange, everybody. Sit crisscross applesauce and let's get to some show and tell where we show you a chart and tell you a story. U.S. Steel is down 15% since Wednesday's news that President Biden opposed its takeover by Japan's Nippon Steel. The president says it's vital for it to remain an American steel company that's domestically owned and operated. On the other hand, U.S. Steel says the deal would benefit union workers, the American steel industry, and American national security. Now, remember, Cleveland-Cliffs started all this by making an unsolicited buyout offer for U.S. Steel back in August. That offer was rejected and resulted in a bidding process that Japan's Nippon Steel eventually won. But Cleveland-Cliffs CEO Lorenzo Gonsalves is still holding out hope for a win here.
I have full conviction that this deal between Nippon Steel and the union will never happen. We have an agreement with the USW. We have the right to bid on their behalf. We understand the successorship clause. That's something that clearly Nippon Steel has no clue about. And we are going to prevail.
Well, coming up, single-family home construction rebounded last month as the weather warms up and demand holds steady. But one developer still sees more supply issues ahead, even if mortgage rates drop. That's next when The Exchange comes right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. The Spider Home Builder ETF higher today after the housing market shows more signs of resilience. February starts posting their biggest increase in 9 months. And Diana Olick joins me now to look closer at that data. Diana?
Well, John, strong buyer demand and moderating mortgage rates pushed housing starts higher in February, specifically in single family, which rose to the highest level since April of 2022. Single family starts were up nearly 12% from January, multifamily up nearly 9%. While single family is up 35% from February of last year, multifamily is down about the same amount. And that's because there is an oversupply of rental apartments right now, with record new supply coming online. Now, mortgage rates were slightly higher in February than they were at the end of the year, but builders have been buying down those rates aggressively so they don't affect new home buyers as much as they do existing home buyers. Building permits, which are an indicator of future construction, were up just 1% for single family from January and a stronger 8% for multifamily. But compared with a year ago, again, single family much higher and multi much lower. Now, the builders said in their sentiment survey for March that demand for single family was brisk. So it looks like we'll see stronger starts in the coming months unless there is some dramatic move higher in rates. John?
Diana, is the incentive that we're seeing across different segments in line with those same fluctuations in demand, whether it's single family, multifamily, et cetera?
The incentives in terms of what?
In terms of kind of paying down the mortgage rates for people. I imagine
right.
a single family is stronger.
Yes,
maybe they don't
absolutely.
Have to do it as much, at least in certain markets.
Right. Now, incentives for single family are you're buying down the mortgage rates, it's adding amenities to the home, and in some cases, they are lowering the prices. Now, for the rental side, the multifamily, rents are actually been moderating, coming down a little bit, so you're not seeing the concessions that you used to see maybe 1 or 2 years ago. So again, you're seeing actually more concessions than you would have 1 or 2 years ago, because 2 years ago there was so much competition that rents were just rising and the landlords didn't have to do anything. Now they might be giving you a free month's rent, or they might be adding the parking in for a couple of months. So we are seeing more of those concessions on the rental side.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess I was thinking about condos, but that wouldn't fit. Diana, thank you. Well, despite a strong February for construction, our next guest expects the housing shortage to get worse in the near term, even if mortgage rates come down. Joining me now is David O'Reilly, CEO at the Howard Hughes Holdings. Howard Hughes develops, owns, and operates commercial, residential, and mixed-use real estate. David, I want to start on incentives, because we've been talking a lot about that lately, and I just wonder, across different markets and different price points, you're kind of on the higher end here, how much are you needing to incentivize?
Well, we're selling land to the home builders, and our home builder partners that are selling those homes, the really only incentive they're putting out there has been a rate buy down. And most of that has been relatively modest. We've seen public home builders post margins north of 25%, some close to 30 for almost 2 years now, which is a sign of their strength. And it's representative of the supply demand imbalance. We have so much more demand than their supply. The amount of incentives a home builder needs to offer right now is not meaningful.
Now, what about the labor that it takes to develop that land? Right, for a long time, especially during the pandemic, it was really tough to get the labor and to get the materials needed to get the building done. How has that shifted?
It's become a little bit easier. The labor is more readily available. The materials that we need, you know, we're talking 16-foot sewer pipes in some instances, are not, you know, off the shelf at Home Depot or Lowe's. These are custom ordered, coming largely from overseas. We're able to get those materials and get them in appropriate pricing these days.
What's the power of cash in this market? I imagine if you need to borrow a lot to get a project done versus if you've got access to capital, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, we've sit on large cash balances at Howard Hughes specifically for that reason. We need to deliver those amenities that our consumers, our residents demand in our master plans, and being able to put more cash of equity into those developments that help us to achieve loans in a difficult lending market at much lower rates.
Now, you say that you're seeing a lot of demand for the higher end amenity communities, mm-hmm. where you got your pool and your fitness and whatever else right close to you, and you're close to work. That's interesting to me. I don't know if it's unique to the areas where you're operating, because a lot of times in hot real estate markets, you see people pushing out to the exurbs, just trying to get into whatever they can afford.
The demand we're seeing right now is for a quality of life, and that quality of life is largely driven by access to outdoors access to trail system, great schools for their children, and short commutes to work. As this return to office is continuing to take hold, having a, you know, 5 or 10 minute commute is so much different than an hour train ride. That's driving a lot of buying decisions, and we're seeing more and more folks moving into our communities every day seeking that quality of life.
Is there a flip side to that, where there are people who had moved farther away when remote work looked like it was more of the future than it is, and now the demand has shifted?
Yeah, we've seen a remigration into these, you know, walkable urban communities, like communities like Summerlin outside of Las Vegas or Bridgeland outside of Houston, which are those live, work, play, learn, discover communities that seem to be at the middle of the bullseye for consumer demand right now.
There have been some stories out there, you know, some months ago about
designs changing so that homes were smaller so people would be able to afford them. Are you not seeing that in the markets where you operate?
No, we're absolutely seeing that. Over the past 5 years, the average home size has come down about 8 to 10%, but it's still double what it was in the 80s. I don't know how you grew up, but I had a bunk bed and a shared bathroom down the hall. I think now everybody has their own ensuite bathroom, home office, three-car garage. Consumer demand over the past 4 years has really exploded in terms of the size of the home. The price per square foot of the home hasn't meaningfully outpaced inflation. So when we talk about affordability, a lot of it's consumer demand driven, not as much it just costs that much more to build a home today.
Yeah, brownstone and Bed-Stuy here, not a McMansion. So I guess it's shrunk a little bit from the peaks there, but not back to normal. So it's great to have you and your perspective there on what's happening in the housing market, which affects, I mean, eventually all of us. Thank you, David O'Reilly from Howard Hughes. And, you know, as we look at the markets, there has been quite a rebound in the major averages starting around 11 a.m. Right up into the 1 o'clock hour. And you can see there the Dow holding steady near the highs throughout this hour, but not exactly clear how that's going to end up. That's why you got to keep watching CNBC. That's going to do it for The Exchange.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.